Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode CXX, Adultery. By modern standards, the Romans had some fairly unusual ideas, which could be putting it mildly when it comes to the subject of adultery. Now, for the most part, the Romans seemed fairly lax in repercussions when it came to who was shagging who, unless, of course, you were embarrassing a man of high status. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Adultery is having sex outside of marriage, but it does particularly apply to married women in Roman culture. So for a man, having sex with a woman or with a boy was not considered adultery, as long as that woman or boy is in the right category to not have any rights that matter. In other words, if that woman is a slave or a woman of very low status or something like an actress or a shopkeeper, that's fine as far as the Romans care. If the woman is married to another man, then it is adultery. So it's only really adultery for a married woman in all cases. For a man, there are certain categories of other people that he can sleep with, but he can commit adultery if it's with another woman who is also married. They would call that adulteria on his part.
Okay, so there's good adultery and bad adultery.
Yeah, and they wouldn't call it adultery if it's the good kind. It's right. Acceptable.
Okay.
It's never acceptable for a married woman.
So a man
there's
wrote
a
these
bias
rules?
There.
Yeah?
There's a double standard in Roman society, as there are in so many, based along gender terms.
Okay. Were these the rules across the entire history of the Roman Empire?
No. Well, not across the imperial period at all, but across the Republic, as far as we know. So it's a rule that you can break, but it's not necessarily grounds for divorce, but it can be grounds for divorce. A man can divorce his wife, giving the grounds as adultery. However, divorce is very easy to obtain anyway.
Okay.
And really, you might want to claim adultery if you wanted to keep the dowry or something like that. All right. So you could just divorce anyway, just on the basis that you want to marry someone else more useful to you. And most of the cases we know of are from the Roman elite. So that already puts different pressures on it, because it might be about money, it might be about status, that you want to marry into a different family and make that alliance. What that means is that, in a way, there's not much point for a Roman man in committing adultery with a woman of his class who is available for marriage, because he could just divorce his wife and marry her anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And also, Roman marriage is not considered something that's a romantic prospect anyway for the Roman elites. All right, it's very much an alliance between families in the Republic.
Say, if I'm married, I can go and sleep with other people. That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
What if the people that I'm sleeping with are married? That's fine, unless they are a woman.
Yes. Look, really, if it's another male, it should be somebody younger
okay.
or of lower status. Okay. So
yeah.
there are quite strict rules about this. So it shouldn't be a freeborn boy. That would be bad.
Of course.
And it certainly shouldn't be somebody from a similar status to yourself, if I'm assuming you're an elite male. So there are certain protected categories. And freeborn males, for example, wear a little sort of medallion called the bulla, which is meant to protect them. And it's kind of protecting them against those kinds of predations.
Yeah, wow.
There are societal rules about what you should and shouldn't do. We think they've probably been altered and changed. But there seem to have been regulations about this in what is called the 12 Tables, which is a set of laws written down in 450 BCE.
Yeah.
Very, very early. We don't have the written text of those laws, but we can sort of piece them together from various later writings. So marriage also changes over time. Early on, the father has a lot more control over his daughter, and this probably applied to all social classes. And he transferred his daughter to the husband, and the husband effectively became the father figure.
Yeah, it's a head
wife.
Of the household kind of
yeah.
thing.
It's what's called manus marriage. Manus means hand.
Yeah.
And that you've kind of got control over your daughter, and then you give her to the husband and he's got control. But that manus marriage was actually dying out by the period which we've got much evidence for.
Yeah.
And you might think that sounds good for a woman. She gets transferred from her father to marriage and she's no longer under the thumb, as it were, under the hand of her husband. But in fact, what it meant was she's basically still part of her father's family and he still exerts control. So he can sort of pull her out of that marriage easily.
Really? Yeah.
Deploy her somewhere else.
Which we know did happen. Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Of course, yeah. Augustus did that. Yes. Yeah.
I guess what we should say, especially in current context, is that marriage for the Romans is between a man and a woman.
Mm.
They don't have it between same sex at all. Yeah. Although there are plenty of same-sex relationships or versions of relationships going on. But for the elites, which we have most evidence for, that's because it's about an alliance between two families and the production of offspring will kind of cement that alliance. So that's the specific reason why what the Romans called connubium, marriage, is a right given to particular people. It's a right that doesn't apply to slaves. It's a right that doesn't apply to actors and gladiators and people who are considered unspeakable or infamous.
Wow. Okay.
And also, I should say, we don't know of Roman women who weren't married.
Mm.
If they were free-born Roman women, they always seem to have been married off if they lived long enough.
Yeah, because, you know, to a Roman man, what, you know, what else is a daughter good for? I don't want to, you know, put it that way, but they're very useful for making business arrangements by the sounds of it.
Yeah, to a certain extent and within certain types of families. Also, it's important that the woman produce children and that they be legitimate children. And also, I guess, depending on your financial standing, a girl is a drain on the finances.
Mm.
And you need to produce a dowry for her as well. So there's kind of a necessity in marrying her to the right kind of family.
Yeah. And you mentioned that we don't know any single women from Rome at that point, but we should put the disclaimer of Vestals in there. Otherwise, we'll get somebody complaining in the comments section somewhere.
And they are only very elite women. So they are extremely exceptional because there may have been lower status women who weren't married and we just don't know about them because we don't have something written down about it. But we do know usually about more elite women, and you could only be a Vestal if you came from one of the most aristocratic families. Even Vestals, though, could get married eventually because they had a term of office that was 30 years and then they were set free.
Mm.
And some of them did marry after that.
And how important was that concept of fertility and chastity when it came to marriage in the Roman world?
Is really important. And we do have records of some men divorcing wives for sterility. So it's kind of the woman who gets blamed in that situation.
Yeah.
We do also know of marriages that were maintained despite the non-production of offspring.
Mm.
One of the famous ones is Augustus and Livia. So it's not an automatic route to divorce. And chastity is really, really important. Chastity in Latin is pudicitia, and it's the most important quality for a respectable Roman woman. And this is one of the cases where we can actually talk about ordinary women because this is a quality that often turns up on the eulogistic tombstones of particular women, often written by their husbands, that they were both fertile and faithful and chaste within the marriage.
Mm.
Right, this is high praise for a woman. This is the right kind of woman.
But if they weren't, that would have been grounds for divorce. And here, I suppose, we can talk about Caesar, if you like, and pull that example out.
The famous incident that surrounds this idea of female chastity within marriage is where we get the quote, Caesar's wife from. Caesar's wife must be beyond suspicion.
Mm.
I have to say this is possibly an excuse for Caesar to divorce Pompeia, his wife at the time. And she was his wife at the time that he has an important priesthood of Jupiter. And she therefore has to carry out rituals herself.
Mm.
And one of them is to host the festival or a ritual of the Bona Dea, the good goddess. And in 62 BCE, she has this ritual in their household and it's meant to be attended only by women. But the good old playboy character Clodius invades the ritual dressed as a woman. He manages to get in drag and he's found out. And there's not really any question that he has had sex with Caesar's wife. But the merest suspicion of it in this women-only setting where there's nobody to watch on, nobody to make sure that this hasn't happened, is reason for Caesar to divorce Pompeia.
Yeah.
It may have been the reason he gave. In a way, it doesn't matter because the fact that he can say, my wife must be beyond suspicion, means to me that it is a viable reason in Roman society. even if it was just an excuse.
That was legally okay for him to go and do that.
Yeah, but as I say, divorce is not difficult in Rome. Yes. Really, the only thing for somebody of Caesar's standing that might prevent you is if it were to antagonize her family, and her family are people you want to keep on board.
Mm. So is it fair to say that adultery is only adultery if somebody finds out about it?
It is fair to say that. And indeed, I guess it's adultery if the husband decides to recognize it as such. There may have been many cases where he decided to just
turn a blind eye to what was going on. Yeah.
I think that I come over as very cynical about Roman marriage, but we do know of cases where there was a lot of affection within marriages, even some elite marriages. Mm. And that may have been a reason for a spouse to forgive. So it may have been strategic forgiveness, or it may have been real. And I guess because emotions are not constituted in exactly the same way as they are for us, that it might not have been as hurtful or offensive. It's much more a shameful thing, I think, for a Roman woman because of that really significant category of pudicitia, chastity.
But we've got examples of those virtues being held up as something to be admired. So there's clearly this thought that to be chaste, to be honourable, to have those sort of virtues is admirable and maybe not the situation that you find all the time.
Yes. Look, I think it's further complicated by the fact that these constant tensions in Roman society and social mores. Because while on the one hand, and it kind of escalates in the Republic, you've got elite women being married and remarried several times.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if their husband dies, the expectation is that they will be married off to somebody else. But at the same time, they have this ideal of the woman who's only married once. They call it an univira, a one-man woman. And there aren't many of these women. If there is a woman who has been married once, and it'd be even better if she's already produced lots of children, and then if her husband dies, she refuses to marry again, she could be, you know, put up on the pedestal.
Sure.
As the thing to be attained that most women won't get the opportunity to attain because they'll be forced to remarry. So the one who is the greatest example of this is Cornelia, the mother of the Gracchi, from the kind of mid-second century BCE. She is married to Gracchus. She produces 12 children, and he dies. And then she is actually courted by a Hellenistic king, by a Greek king.
Wow.
And she says no.
Okay.
So she remains an univira. My God, she's unbelievably perfect, Cornelia. And then she has tragedy because all of her children die before her. So
it's kind
of the awful and yet, for the Romans, perfect story. She's the perfect woman.
Yes. Did you want to read out this inscription that you've got here? That feels applicable there.
Okay, yeah. So this epitaph, which is from considerably later, is from at least the second century CE, possibly even later than that, but it is from Rome, and it does tell us something about ordinary women, which we can't get from a lot of our literary texts. It's written from the point of view of the husband and shows us what he values about her. Her name's Aguileia Prima. To Aguileia Prima, wife beyond eternity, most chaste and modest and frugal, who loved her husband and his house and all his possessions innocently. Quintus Oppius Secundus, her husband, made this for the deserving one. Mm. But this is the tomb. What's prized is that she's chaste, modest, and frugal. They often talk about care with money in these inscriptions, but particularly she loved her husband. So look, at least whether this is true or not, the ideal is that there is marital affection.
Mm-hmm.
And she loved his house, and that presumably means his household too. But the bit I like best is all his possessions innocently. She wasn't stealing things from him.
She made the slaves dust the right
things. Yeah, I was going to say, they seem to be, although I've said ordinary, the fact that he can afford an inscription of this length, because it's longer actually than I've read out, I left out a little bit there, means that there must have been some money there and they would have had slaves.
So this is how marriage was more or less during the Republican era, as far as the law is concerned, and attitudes might be a bit different. But how did the law change in Rome's time? When did the first big upheaval come when it came to marriage laws?
The really big upheaval, and it is the biggest one that ever happens, is under the first emperor, Augustus. And about 10 years into his tenure as princeps or emperor, he brings in what is called the Julian marriage law. sometimes called the Augustan marriage laws, because there's a succession of really moral code laws.
Mm-hmm.
And the big change here is that adultery becomes a criminal act. So it becomes a
for
public
women?
Affair. Yes.
For men, we're for still fine.
For men, if it's with a married woman.
All right, okay. All right. I just want to keep my options open. No. Yeah, okay, so...
You're saying that from a private point of view?
No, I just mean from the yeah, questions that I'm going to ask. So it becomes a public affair.
Yes, the law that really matters is from around 18 to 17 BCE. And it becomes something that has to be prosecuted. That is the law. This is kind of the culmination of this feeling that the Romans have that their society has been falling apart. They've had civil war. They've had the dissolution of the Republic.
Yep.
And if they can only build back their moral codes, then their society will sort of right itself again.
Mm-hmm.
And for Augustus, there is this general feeling that it's particularly the immorality, the bad behavior of elite Romans that has led to this terrible situation of civil war. The elite Romans haven't been marrying enough. They haven't been producing legitimate children enough. You know, some of those big families have died out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that they haven't been having sex. They've been having sex with the wrong people and everybody's been having affairs. And he kind of zones in on the behavior of women. Some women have been too powerful and too influential and too free with their favors. So there's this direct correlation made between the immoral behavior of women, or the too free behavior of women, and the terrible straits that the Roman state had been in yeah. a way that I think is completely illogical.
But yeah.
It made sense for the elite Romans of the time.
Clearly women have had it too good for too long.
Yep, they're not going to have it much longer.
All right, so what were these laws? Can you take me through them? There were two of them?
There were two laws at that point.
Yeah.
The first one concerned adultery, or one of them rather concerned adultery, and was called the Lex Iulia de Adulteriis Coercendis, the law punishing adultery. And it was called the Julian law, the Lex Iulia, which is unusual because usually the law is named after one of the consuls of that year or both.
Yep.
And Augustus names it after his family name, not the consuls. Mm. So it kind of personalizes it. This is my law on this. And a summary of that is that a woman and her lover, if caught in adultery, can be killed. They can only be killed in particular circumstances. And that is if they are caught in the father's house or in the woman's husband's house
mm-hmm.
by the father of the woman.
If the husband catches it, you're
fine. He's not allowed to kill them.
If the father catches, then he can but doesn't have to.
No. The husband
yeah.
can kill the lover.
The husband can kill the lover.
If it's in his house.
If it's in his house.
Yes.
I feel that there's a story behind this law that we don't know.
Well, look, I think it speaks to that change of the father still having ultimate authority over his daughter, even when she's married.
Mm.
I've said many times before to you, I'm sure you're sick of hearing it, that Rome was a patriarchal society in the true sense. Patriarchy doesn't mean the rule of men. It means the rule of the father.
Mm.
The worst crime you could commit in Roman society was to kill your father. Disobeying your father is a hideous crime in itself. So it's the father who still has power in this situation, and he has the authority to wipe out this shame on his family, I guess you can read it as.
Mm. It's such a particular scenario that it gives you. You can only kill them under these circumstances. You can only kill this person. This person needs to find that person in this setting.
Mm-hmm.
I can't help but wonder if, you know, in modern days how there's a trial at some point of something unprecedented
mm-hmm.
and it sets a precedence.
Exactly.
And suddenly you've got future court cases referring back to the other ruling that happened in this circumstances, and that's how an obscure law can be made. Can't lead a donkey down the main street on a Tuesday. That's a law.
Yeah, you can still kill a Welshman in Coventry.
Can you really?
Apparently.
Go at it. Sorry to our Welsh listeners living in Coventry. But, you know, that's what this feels like. But that's not all that this law is.
That's kind of the most shocking aspect of it. But as you say, it is very specific circumstances if you catch this couple in flagrante, basically.
Sorry, what was that word you just used?
Two words, in flagrante.
Yeah.
In
okay.
flagrant.
Yeah. Okay.
In the act.
Latin speakers can get away with saying dirty stuff and people will just think it's academic speak.
It's not academic. It's legal. It's legalese, actually.
Sure.
The husband, though, and this, I think, is the more likely scenario, and also because it's more likely, kind of nasty, that if the husband knows his wife is committing adultery, he has to divorce her. It is now law that he has to do so. He cannot turn a blind eye from it and pretend it's not happening.
So if it's publicly announced and out there and becomes a scandal, you've got to divorce
her. Yeah, or if anyone knows and decides to tell the authorities.
That's interesting, yeah.
And you have 60 days to do that. And if you don't do it as the husband, then you will be charged as a pimp.
Right.
Because clearly, if you're allowing your wife to have sex with other men and not doing anything about it, then the implication is that you are actually benefiting from it.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't announced yourself as a pimp and you're not paying tax on it. That's not actually in the law, but that would be the implication.
But that's
if you
the
were,
implication.
Because pimping and prostitution aren't illegal in Roman society, but you have to be on record and giving tax to the Roman state.
Okay.
So yes, a husband can be charged as a pimp if he decides not to prosecute his wife for adultery.
All right.
If he does divorce his wife and the adultery is considered proven, then she and her lover will be exiled to separate islands.
Assuming that the lover hasn't been killed.
Yeah, assuming that he hasn't been caught and killed. Exactly. But I think this also speaks to the fact that this is really about the Roman elite. Because who has the capacity to exile their wife to an island unless they've already got a lot of money?
Yeah.
So I don't think Augustus really cared about the vast mass of the ordinary populace. You know, you've got to have a lot of property for that to matter.
Yeah, okay. Being the emperor who came up with these laws, Augustus felt compelled to carry them out and set a good example, in his own house?
I guess so, because one of the few, or two of the few examples we know of this actually happening, because I think in the vast majority of cases, it would have been possible to keep it covered up.
Yeah.
They concern Augustus's own household, in that he was forced to exile both his daughter, his only child, apart from by adoption, and his granddaughter, his daughter's daughter. The first case was his daughter Julia, who, if people remember back as far as the Augustus podcast, might remember that she was multiply married herself in the way of Roman elite women. Mm. She had been married first to Marcellus, her cousin, and then she was married to Agrippa, with whom she had five children, and then she was married to Tiberius. And it was while she was married to Tiberius that she was accused of multiple adulteries, and she had to be exiled, and she died in exile. So Suetonius tells us that Augustus took this really hard, this news that Julia was committing adultery. And he says, he, Augustus, bore the death of his kin with far more resignation than their misconduct. For he was not greatly broken by the fate of Gaius and Lucius. Gaius and Lucius are actually the sons of Julia, whom he'd adopted as his heirs.
For a time,
yes. Died very young. But he informed the Senate of his daughter's fall through a letter read in his absence by a quaestor, and for very shame would meet no one for a long time, and even thought of putting her to death, which he doesn't have the right to do unless he caught her at it, remember?
Mm.
So he thought about going further than his own law. At all events, when one of her confidants, a freedwoman called Phoebe, hanged herself at about the same time, he said, "I would rather have been Phoebe's father."
Yikes. Okay. That's how big the shame was for him at that point.
Now, Julia gets banished, and Julia, at least in depictions of her, was apparently a party girl, which is probably part of the problem. And she is depicted in much, much later texts, and I mean 5th century CE, as telling lots of jokes, one of which is somebody asked her how all her children looked like their father, even though she was known to play around.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that she didn't take on... what did she say? She didn't take on any new cargo unless the ship was full, which meant she was already pregnant.
Yeah.
She was already pregnant when she committed adultery.
Yeah, it sounds much classier in the original Latin.
Well, I don't know if it does, actually. Anyway, Suetonius goes on. After Julia was banished, he denied her the use of wine and every form of luxury, and he would not allow any man, slave or free, to come near her without his permission, and then not without being informed of his stature, complexion, and even of any marks or scars upon his body. It was not until 5 years later that he moved her from the island to the mainland and treated her with somewhat less rigour. but he would not recall her, even though prevailed upon by the Roman people.
Right. Okay. So that so much was the shame.
She died in exile. And he had to exile his granddaughter too, the second Julia, the daughter of Julia. She's sometimes called Julia the Younger, Julia Minor. Now, she's sort of seen in conjunction with her brother, Agrippa Postumus, who was also exiled. He just seems to have been disliked by Augustus and seen as rather brutish and unsuitable to be his heir. He never becomes the heir. This is, I think, the most upsetting part of the whole Julia the Younger story. She's accused of adultery and she is also exiled. She's exiled in 8 CE. Same year Ovid was exiled, and some people try to make a connection there, but it's entirely supposition.
Here is my longbow. Watch me draw it.
And he wasn't exiled to an island, so it doesn't really work. Okay, but when she was exiled, she was pregnant. Augustus would not allow the child born to his granddaughter Julia after her sentence to be recognized or reared. So in other words, because this is a child he regards as born out of adultery, the father has to recognize it, or the paterfamilias, which is what he is. But also he wouldn't allow it to be reared. That means it was exposed and killed.
Oh,
yeah. It's horrible.
Yeah.
It's beyond our understanding, but that's how disgusting he felt.
Mm.
Every mention of the Julias, he would sigh deeply and cry out, "Would that I had ne'er wedded, and would I had died without offspring." And he never alluded to them except as his three boils and his three ulcers. That's the two Julias and Agrippa Postumus. So these are just diseases to him. Okay, so that's Augustus, whom I feel these days would be under the care of a psychotherapist for those kind of attitudes. But he does bring in this kind of moral regeneration, and this is meant to be part of the moral regeneration of Rome, that the adultery of women will not be acceptable and must be punished in a criminal court.
So those are the changes that Augustus brought in, and they were long-lasting. But as far as the law goes, and maybe standards as well, did Rome change after that at all? How was adultery perceived and dealt with?
Okay, adultery obviously still occurs, and this seems to be one of those laws that is considered so harsh that it isn't often prosecuted. Mm. It kind of backfires. Like, you know, when the law was that you should be hanged for stealing anything, often judges would not actually declare someone guilty. Also, no law is going to stop adultery. So we think that this was often ignored and was completely ineffective. But Augustus didn't give up. I mean, he had two laws that year. And by the way, the other one was one that tried to encourage women to marry again if they were divorced or widowed.
Okay.
And he brought in another law in 9 CE, which again was a marriage law, which tried to offer kind of tax breaks and it was kind of concession, stick and carrot for not having at least three children. So women got a certain amount of freedom if they had had three children within marriage.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So he does kind of continue with this moral crusade.
It's a baby bonus.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's also playing around with people from different status levels, can't marry each other, trying to regulate people's personal lives. Mm. This is really the government getting inside your own household. And many people have said, I think with some reason, trying to regulate the female body in particular. So it's Augustus's thing, if you like, and it's something he doesn't give up on. The next law he brings in 9 CE, which is a year after he's exiled his granddaughter. But we don't really hear about it that much. There's a story in Tacitus of a husband being potentially prosecuted because he hasn't prosecuted his wife.
Mm.
And he says, oh, well, the 60 days aren't up, and so that's okay.
Yeah.
So it's still kind of going on there under Tiberius.
But then you get to somebody like, is it Domitian?
Domitian really brings it back with a vengeance.
Domitian exiles his wife for adultery?
Yeah, but then he brings her back and remarries her.
Yeah.
So he's not very consistent with it, not like Augustus. They will not come back from exile.
Yeah, yeah. But just the fact that that's going on.
Domitian tries to reinstate this moral code. For example, we know that under Domitian is the first Vestal in a long time who's punished for apparent lack of chastity.
Mm.
You know, the whole being buried alive, hideous death. And with Domitian, our sources see it as very hypocritical because they see him as acting immorally, particularly the incest with his niece. And I think it's something that perhaps comes up at times of instability or when an emperor wants to really put his mark on Roman private life. But apart from Augustus and Domitian, it's there. It's a law that exists, but we know of very few prosecutions, and it's likely that it was rarely enacted.
So how far was the influence of these sort of marriage laws then? How far did they take the empire?
Well, technically, they stayed on the books for centuries and really only started to be repealed when Constantine embraced Christianity.
Yeah.
They were sort of seen as incompatible with Christian moral codes, even though Christianity also did not advocate adultery. It certainly wouldn't advocate killing a family member. But really, the full repeal, I guess, is one of those things that bits of it remain on the books until somebody decides to do a real overhaul of the legal code, and that happens under Justinian, which is in the mid-6th century.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review. They are always read and muchly appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for this episode of When in Rome. So until the next one, I'm Matt Smith. You have been fantastic. And thanks for listening.